Rick is a long-term member of Socialist Alternative for many, many decades now. He is also was the convener in Canberra of the anti-war movement at the high point of the anti-war movement in Australia, and is kind of uniquely able to talk on this topic as one of the people who is an editor for Class and Struggle in Australia. So people should make Rick feel welcome.
You may have heard earlier this year that Oxfam released its annual report about the distribution of wealth. Now you might think Oxfam, it is a multinational corporation, but it's also a charity. Maybe it's a bit suspect, but actually the statistics that it used are from Credit Suisse, a Swiss bank. And the information that they provide is very revealing about class on a global scale. Today, only the richest 1% of people on the planet own more than the rest of humanity combined. 61 people own more than the poorest half of the world's population. In Australia, the top 1% own 23% of the wealth and more than the bottom 70%. This is a basic description of class on a global scale. Class has implications for how people live their lives, not just in terms of income and wealth. The class that you are a member of will influence the extent to which you're unemployed or underemployed, or whether you need to be employed at all. There is a major correlation between class and health. There were studies conducted in the 1990s called the Westminster Studies, because they were mainly of British public servants, large sample size, over 10,000, to look at the relationship between people's health and where they were in the public service hierarchy. Now, if you listen to the bleatings of CEOs about how stressful their jobs are, how damaging it is for their lives, you might think that people up the top would be more prone to bad health, or at least to stress-related poor health, heart attacks and so on. That's simply not the case. There was a strict correlation between where you were in the hierarchy and your health. And the higher up you went, the healthier you were. And there's a relatively straightforward way of explaining this, at least from a Marxist perspective, because stress actually is a major contributor to health, and the lower down you are in a hierarchy, the less control that you have over your working life, that is, over the best hours in your adult life, the more stressful it is and the worse your health is. This is essentially the conclusion that the authors of the study, particularly the principal researcher, Michael Marmot, came to. Stress and where you are in the hierarchy are very, very correlated. And Marmot's not a Marxist. He was describing what was going on. There are other correlations between class and other aspects of our lives besides income and wealth. So what intelligence tests measure, which I want to emphasise is not really intelligence of any particular kind, but what intelligence tests measure is correlated with class as well, quite apart from the correlation between going to an elite private school and being a member of the ruling class. Then there's the question of law, how you're treated by the law if you're up high or down low. I won't go into details about that. Then there's taxation. If you are a worker, you pay tax. If you're an owner of massive amounts of shares, tax is sort of optional. Then there's recreation, but we'll get on to recreation a bit later. Mikey. There's also the question of politics. How much influence do you or I have when we go to our local... Well, first off, we send a member to our local member. What do we get back? If we get anything back, we get a form letter that some shit kicker has copied from a file of form letters for you. If your name is something similar, and you don't fuck around with your local member, you get on the blower to the Prime Minister's office or the Treasurer, and somebody will pick up and listen to what you have to say and in all possibility arrange for you to actually have a chat with the Prime Minister or with the Treasurer. Right. But how is class explained in general terms? I'm going to concentrate on Marxist explanations of class. Oh, we went on to leisure. I want to briefly talk about other ways of looking at class. One way of looking at class is to ignore it. And I think this is a prime example of ignoring class. Anybody can play polo, you know. You just have to have an interest in horses and burning money, and you can play polo. But conservatives have also used the degenerate concept of class in their polemics. They've devalued the term class. So they talk about elites or a new class versus battlers, ordinary folk. And the distinctive thing about elites is that they're concerned about humanitarian sorts of issues. They care about refugees. They're worried about unequal treatment for women. The fact that gay people couldn't get married, that sort of thing, which ordinary people, the battlers, like Bricky's labourers, nurses in hospitals, senior managers in Westpac, those sorts of people, those people aren't really interested in. We're not going to deal any further with that approach to class. But the most common approach to class is a highly descriptive approach, which can match the approach that is taken by Oxfam. That is, we talk about different slices through society in terms of wealth and income in particular. And that can be quite useful. You can see what sort of income or wealth structure there is in society, and you can describe that. Now, in terms of the number of classes, well, it's sort of arbitrary where you draw the line. Does the bottom class end once you earn $15,000 or $20,000? Where's the next layer? It's sort of arbitrary. Sometimes this is combined, high sophistication, with talk about social and cultural capital, and you have a three-dimensional model where you have economic class, which is about wealth and income, and you have class in social terms, which is the sort of jobs your mates have, and then you have class in cultural terms, which is whether you go to rock concerts, drink in a pub, or you go to the opera and ballet and have cocktails in a highly expensive establishment with limited entry for ordinary folk. But for Marxists, class is not about simply describing the world. It's about understanding the way the world works. It's an analysis that underpins our understanding of society. For Marxists, class is about social relations. It's a fundamental feature of the underlying structure of society. It's not just a description of the warts on the surface of society, but it's an effort to understand what's going on below the surface to make that appearance on the surface occur. What lies behind the various kinds of inequality, particularly in wealth and income, which certainly is important? Well, for Marxists, the answer is power. The capacity to shape events, including especially to shape our own lives. And the most important source of that power is grounded in, a little bit of Marxist jargon here, the social relations of production. In other words, the specific way control over productive resources and labour is organised. So the specific way in which the machinery, the equipment, the buildings and so on the one hand, and on the other hand, the labour of those who make the machines go round, who occupy the buildings, the way in which they are organised together. So the issue here is not just the features of individuals, their status or accent or even their detailed income, but their relationships with other people. Class is about social relations in production. And production is important, not because, you know, why not look at production, but because that is where humanity creates much of what it needs to survive. The food, shelter, clothing, tools, toys, these are produced by human beings, by human labour. And what's more, humanity spends most of the best adult working hours engaged in this productive activity. Now, class in this sense has not always existed. In hunter-gatherer societies, there was no social layer which exercised ownership or effective control over productive resources to the exclusion of other members of the group. Human beings evolved in classless societies and as a highly collaborative species. And I think that there's going to be another talk at the conference about this kind of society or these kinds of societies, because they were widespread and they were diverse before class societies emerged. Look at your neighbour's eyes. Just quickly, what do you notice? Well, one of the things that you notice is the whites. Yeah? Unless your neighbour is somewhat under the weather, they have whites in their eyes. That's called the sclera. Unlike other primates and other mammals, it is thought, that is in order that others can easily see where we are looking. This aids collaboration as opposed to competition with other members of the species. The Economist, which is like a house magazine for the international bourgeoisie, the international capitalist class, with its dogmatically free market line, concedes that, and I quote, the advantages of cooperation seem to have outweighed those of competition when it came to human evolution. Class only emerges with the production of a social surplus which enables some able-bodied people not to work, to live effectively off the labour of others. Classes were the result of new relations of production, which created fundamental imbalances of power between those who laboured to create wealth and those who did not but benefited from the labour of others. Now, at this point, I'm going to skip over class relations in pre-capitalist class societies, feudalism, or more broadly, the tributary mode of production, which was generally the form of pre-capitalist class society. I want to get on to where we're at now, which is capitalism. Under capitalism, a thin layer, capitalists own, or what amounts to the same thing, effectively controls society's productive resources. This gives them immense power over everyone else. In particular, to make a living, workers have to sell their ability to work, their labour power, to capitalists, to people who have the wherewithal to pay them so they have a wage so that they can continue to exist. The thing is, though, that new value is created by human labour. It is only created by human labour. Workers are paid enough in wages to keep them going, and the new additional value that is created in the production process, which they create, is taken by their bosses. This surplus value is the basis for profits. Workers are paid the value of their labour power, that is, enough to be able to reproduce their labour power by eating, sleeping, maybe fucking and producing the next generation of workers as well. So the deal seems to be fair. But still, exploitation is taking place because the bosses get to own the surplus value purely by virtue of their power as owners of productive resources. This is the guts of Marx's labour theory of value, and it is crucial for understanding class and hence for understanding capitalist societies. Class, at least in the sense that we're using it here, is not often mentioned in polite circles. But sometimes the mask slips, especially when those involved in managing a capitalist society speak to business audiences. So in 2002, in a speech at a conference on enterprise bargaining, Tony Abbott, you remember Tony Abbott? At that time, he was the Minister for Industrial Relations, or Workplace Relations. Later on, he was Prime Minister. He said, "I accept that there are plenty of bad bosses out there. But if we're honest, most of us would accept that a bad boss is a little like a bad father or a bad husband. Notwithstanding all his faults, you find he tends to do more good than harm. He might be a bad boss, but at least he's employing someone while he is, in fact, a boss." Well, this is a pretty good commentary on both class in the direct sense and also on the oppression of women and children as well. His predecessor as Minister for Industrial Relations, Peter Reith, made a similar point at a business lunch a few years before. "Well, I'll tell you what, the banks are not perfect, but look, I'll get it through to you. I'm a capitalist. Never forget the history of politics and never forget which side we're on. We're on the side of making profits. We're on the side of people owning private capital." I'm not sure if my accent was accurate, but whether such slips occur or not, during major class struggles, the existence of classes is not hard to detect. But when there are no big class conflicts going on, it's easier to deny the significance of class, but it is still there. And by class struggle, I mean workers against bosses. I mean industrial action and particularly strikes. Not something that we see a lot of, unfortunately, in Australia today. And I say unfortunately because fighting back is the only way that workers can defend, let alone improve their living standards. Okay, sort of legible up the back? Sort of legible. This is a reorganisation of Australian Bureau of Statistics, occupational and status in occupation data into categories which are closer to those of a Marxist class analysis. So, workers. It should have been red, shouldn't it? But never mind. Everybody else. This goes back a few years, but there's no reason to believe that there's been a fundamental shift. 70% of the employed population are workers. That is, they sell their ability to work for a wage. The rest make up 30%, of whom a tiny proportion are the bourgeoisie, that is, the capitalist class. The capitalist class are those who control and or own the means of production, the productive resources of society, and employ wage labour. In larger enterprises, there are those who exercise control over who is employed, what productive resources like machinery, equipment, buildings is bought, what is done with the organisation's money, and the way work is done. And this applies both to public and private sectors. At the top are senior managers and, setting the policy framework, major shareholders in the private sector. In the public sector, their equivalent is the government. This class includes those who not only own but practice control. Whether or not the CEO of a large corporation, Qantas, BHP, Citibank, whatever it is, owns some shares in the corporation, most of them tend to, but whether or not they do, they are exercising effective control and they get a reward for that effective control, a reward that is generally, in the corporations I'm talking about, in the millions, if not tens of millions of dollars a year. The working class, or to use Marxist jargon, the proletariat, does not control means of production. It's those who exercise no or minimal control over their own work or that of others. That is a majority, a large majority, of the employed population or the economically active population. So this includes both manual workers and white-collar workers. Metal workers along with nurses, shop assistants and clerks. This light blue residual category includes the capitalist class, but mostly it's made up of the traditional middle class or petty bourgeoisie, people who are essentially self-employed in a real sense, as opposed to construction workers who are supposedly self-employed on a contract, but in effect their entire labour is controlled by supervisors on the building site. So the petty bourgeoisie own their own means of production but are primarily reliant on their own labour and maybe that of family members. Small shopkeepers, small manufacturers, quite a lot of farmers, some professionals like lawyers, doctors, dentists, accountants in small practices, although increasingly those kinds of professions are being proletarianised, with large corporations moving in to employ doctors, etc., on salaries. Then there's the new middle class, which is a very varied group in what one might call contradictory class locations between the capitalist class and the working class. It includes lower-level managers who supervise some people but also engage in direct forms of labour themselves. They're people who perform some but not all of the functions of capitalists on behalf of their superiors. That is, they generally don't get to decide the overall direction of the corporation or the large public service department, but they do get to boss people who are below them in order to extract as much labour as possible out of them. They exert operational as opposed to strategic control over capital. decisions about day-to-day deployment versus decisions about investment, sale and purchase. Middle management in private enterprise, in the public service, four people and so on are members of the new middle class. And it also includes professionals with some considerable degree of autonomy in bureaucratic organisations, that is, lawyers, accountants and so on, with some say over the way they do their work in a big public service department or in a large private sector corporation, although increasingly these jobs are being proletarianised as well. Their level of control is decreasing. We might finally include amongst these intermediary classes union officials who are neither workers, they don't sell their ability to work to a boss, nor are they bosses themselves. They don't control capital. They play a role in mediating between bosses and workers. So that's an entirely different question that I won't go into detail here. Class provides a vantage point for understanding other social divisions, how these other social divisions fit into society's basic structures. It provides insight to understanding oppressions in terms of gender, race, religion, and so on. This is not to say that other power disparities, like these kinds of oppressions, are unimportant. What it is to say is that they can only be understood, and in the longer term, only effectively combated within the framework of a class analysis of society. What are the implications of class in the realm of ideas, and in particularly in relation to ideas that suggest that some people are inferior, deserve fewer rights than other people? Well, those in power often have an interest in disguising the existence of class in the Marxist sense. Hence the degenerate definitions of class. Alternatively, class is often denied in Australia by reference to mateship. The ruling class has an interest in promoting ideas that suggest that the divisions in society aren't those of class, the fundamental divisions. Ideologies that serve their class interests are generally the prime ideologies in society, the ideas that are most widespread. And these ideas, these ruling class ideas, are the basis for other social cleavages. Racism, sexism, other forms of oppression have appalling real consequences for those they target. In the case of women, of course, the majority of society. But they can only be understood as a product of class societies. August Nimtz, who wrote a really good book about Marx and a bourgeois social theorist, a guy called Alexis de Tocqueville, wrote, "Race is no more than a social construction or invention, while class is far more than a construct. Class for Marx was first and foremost about social relations of production. It had an ontological quality," which I'll translate that into English for you. It related to reality. It was real. That went beyond the particular constructions given to it. The identification of class as a power relation grounded in production that shapes other aspects of society's and individual experience is something that distinguishes Marxism from other approaches rather than a reduction of everything to economics, which is an accusation that is often made of Marxism. So class is a basis for understanding oppression, a lack of control that leads to the expropriation of resources that were held by an oppressed group, like Aborigines, oppression justifying discrimination, and the restriction of the capacity of members of the oppressed group to realise their potential. In this sense, workers are both exploited in the sense I talked about before, creating society's wealth, but not controlling that, the whole of that wealth, because surplus value is extracted from their labour. They're also oppressed because they don't get to shape their own lives. Their lives are shaped by others. Other oppressions can serve capitalist interests because they promote competition amongst workers and distract attention from the real causes of people's problems. So they allow greater exploitation of all, but particularly of the oppressed, and they therefore allow higher profits. Women still earn less than men in Australia. This disadvantages women, obviously. It also disadvantages male workers as well, because, believe it or not, a large proportion of the population live in relationships with members of the other sex. And if one of them is earning less money, that affects the other member or other members of the relationship. Also, these forms of oppression have a red herring kind of function. Look, it's refugees. It's not the capitalist class. It's not the banks. It's not your boss. It's refugees who are A, living off Social Security, and B, stealing your job. So forms of oppression provide powerful means dividing the population, increasing exploitation, and diverting attention from the underlying structure of society, an exploitative society, and blaming victims. Exploitation and oppression are both necessary features of capitalism and have to be fought in all their forms to improve people's lives and in order to overturn this iniquitous system. And when we're talking about overturning this iniquitous system, overturning capitalism, there is hope, because class struggle is built into capitalism. The normal experience of our lives, whether it's at work or that huge training institution for work, which is often called school or university, is about doing what you are fucking told. The mass media promulgate ideas that justify the status quo, that justify oppression, that justify exploitation. But in order to survive as bosses, members of the capitalist class have to extract as much work as they can for as little pay as possible from their employees. Because if they don't, if one capitalist doesn't, his or her competitors will be able to undercut the price of our well-intentioned capitalist, sells their products for on the market. So bosses have an interest in class struggle, and they pursue that class struggle on a consistent basis. But to survive, to physically survive, workers need to try to restrict their effort at work and to maximise their pay. These goals of the bosses and the workers are incompatible. They are contradictory. They give rise to struggle. This conflict is often not visible, but it is permanent potential. At its lowest level, class struggle can take the form of seeing the supervisor walk past and after they've walked past going, that's a pretty low level of class struggle, but it's an indication of people's attitudes. And there are lots of people who are far too polite to do that, but who are not thinking charitable thoughts about their supervisor as he or she walks past. The growth of the working class, now majority of humanity, indicates the huge potential that there is for class struggle to challenge the existing order. Not only that, but there are instances of those struggles spreading across borders. Not only solidarity actions when workers in one country are fighting other workers, black banning goods that are made by scabs or inputs into the production that scabs are engaging in another country, but also in raising money to support strikers. Did you hear the story about the West Virginia teachers? There's actually a session about the West Virginia teachers, about pizza deliveries from across the United States. Well, the pizzas didn't come from across the United States, but the payment for the pizzas came from across the United States from other working people to support those workers. That too was a form of class solidarity. And class struggle, the experience of collective power, not only doing this behind the boss's back, but possibly doing this with large numbers of other people to the boss's face, and even more so, engaging in bans and limitations at work and strike action. That experience of collective power can dissolve ruling ideas so that the working class can come to recognise its tremendous potential collective power to advance our own interests, not only under capitalism, but also smashing it and creating a classless society.